11 minutes past 9 Central African time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Radio Islam International this Sunday evening for a shortened edition of Under the Radar, and for very good reason, as we've just come out of a beautiful and very powerful lecture by Sheikh Hassan Ali, who's on his first official tour to South Africa, courtesy of Al Buruj Press, Qurtuba, and Radio Islam International. And hope you enjoyed every moment of that particular lecture as much as I did, despite the rainy signal on my way to the studio this evening. Was able to capture the gist of that particular lecture, and very, very important points coming through. The Sheikh this evening was in Qurtuba at Masjid Tariq bin Ziyad, a wonderful audience there this evening, as I understand, out in Lynbrook Park, where he spoke on the topic of the final trumpet, minor and major signs of the Day of Judgment. And he made some, you know, really important points while delivering his message in a delightful style. I'm sure many of you would agree with that if you listen to this particular oration of his, or even some of his previous orations. Delightful, keeping the audience rolling, interacting with the audience, but not shying away from the seriousness of this kind of topics that he speaks about. That's Sheikh Hassan Ali, and we're going to be bringing you more of his discourses here in South Africa. He's going to be out in Houghton at the West Street Masjid tomorrow, and the topic there is how to develop khushu' in salah. I guess perhaps one of the most important topics that he's going to discuss, of practical benefit to all of us. And tomorrow he moves, the next day rather, he comes right here to the home of Radio Islam International, in the hometown of Radio Islam International, Lanesia. He'll be at the Nurul Islam Masjid from Maghrib to Aisha. And the topic there, the devil inside, jinn possession, magic, and the evil eye. Back to the show, inshallah, tonight. Two issues that we're going to be looking at. We are looking at Venezuela, the crisis that has enveloped the South American nation. A country that many people had held up as a kind of icon, especially during the years of Hugo Chavez. Many people have now differentiating, or perhaps dissenting views on whether this is a failure of what has been started by Chavez and those just before him, or whether this is, you know, some kind of outside intervention. We're going to dissect those issues this evening and also try to see what is the relevance of what is happening out in Venezuela to South Africa, and where do the kind of ideals that were held up in that particular nation, is it possible to implement those same ideals in South Africa without facing a similar kind of turbulence? And a bit later on in the hour, we just saw a few days ago the anniversary of January the 25th out in Egypt. The failed revolution in one way, another very sad story to deal with, and the very difficult conditions Egyptians face under a dictatorship. We'll be speaking to a member of the Egyptian community in South Africa, an activist in its own right, Khalid Al-Haddad, a bit later on in the hour. But for now, Dr. Dale McKinley is an independent writer, researcher and lecturer based in Johannesburg, longtime political activist who's been involved in the social movement, community and political struggles for over three decades. And Dr. Dale holds a PhD in the political economy and African studies, and occasionally lectures at university level. He's also an author of three books and has written numerous book chapters, research reports, and journal or magazine and press articles on various aspects of South African and international political, social, and economic issues and struggles. And we're obviously going to try to blend the two this evening, using his South African experience to comment on a issue of major international purport at the moment, which is Venezuela, dealing with hyperinflation, power cuts, food medical shortages, and alleged coup. There's malaria, there's millions of Venezuelans fleeing, if those statistics are reliable. How do we make sense of all of this? And is it, as some have tried to argue, a failure of socialist policies in that particular country? Dr. McKinley, good evening. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good evening, and my pleasure.
I really want to take this discussion back to, you know, very, very basic, introductory point. Many people might have some recollection in South Africa of Venezuela when it goes to the days of Hugo Chavez. But for many people, you know, it's just names, it's just rhetoric, but the essential background of Venezuela and where this country came from, where did it go to and where it is now, I think that's where we need to start off with. So firstly, when we talk about Venezuela and perhaps even wider South America, are we talking about countries with a very troubled history of intervention, a very troubled history of meddling, particularly by the United States of America, if that is an appropriate place to start, Dr. McKinley?
Well, I think we can even go back before the United States, which, you know, in terms of United States imperialism and meddling in South and Central America, was predominantly in the 20th century. And if you want to go back in terms of the independence movements and the anti-colonial struggles in much of Central America, that obviously predates the United States of America. I mean, the Spanish and the Portuguese in particular, and the resistance there, not only in places like Venezuela. Simon Bolivar, of course, who Hugo Chavez modeled his revolution after the independence struggles from the colonial power. So there's been a long history in places like Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, Haiti, Jamaica, and so forth, and all sorts of other places, Brazil, and Argentina, Chile, of this kind of history. But if we take to the modern period, in terms of the Chavez, basically what Venezuela was facing, I would say, in the 1960s and 70s was very much similar to what many other Latin American countries are facing. A small elite basically running the show with U.S. backing. So whether that was, you know, in Nicaragua, whether it was in Chile, whether it was in Venezuela, and usually with the backing of a fairly powerful military. So what you had was you had a situation which was, yes, ripe from the early 1900s onwards, with not only American meddling, but a very conservative, elitist, anti-democratic politics, generally speaking, and the accumulation of significant amounts of wealth by a fairly small portion of the population and the impoverishment of a large section of the majority. So that's what the context within which Chavez came to power, and then we can talk from that point.
So was Chavez the first socialist leader or the first leader who espoused ideals that went at odds with the elites in the country, or was he the one who perhaps skyrocketed this kind of ideology and this kind of approach much stronger than any of his predecessors?
Well, I think, you know, Chavez started out as predominantly a nationalist, not a socialist. He invoked Simón Bolívar and the independence and the nationalism of Venezuela, and basically accused the elites of violating those principles and sovereignties and selling the country out to the United States and to foreign interests. That was a very strong critique in the context of a situation of increasing inequalities, much like we have in South Africa. A very small elite owning the vast majority of the wealth, the land, so forth and so on. So it was under those kinds of conditions which he initially tried to, he was a middle-ranking officer in the military, and he tried to foment a coup in the name of the people, and he failed at his first attempt. He was arrested and incarcerated, and then he was freed by a section of the military, which then basically took another stab at that coup and was successful in overthrowing a very conservative government and establishing then a much more radical sort of nationalist politics. It was only once Chavez came to power that he began to talk about socialism, as he began to have close relationships with Cuba, places like Cuba and other Nicaragua and other places like this, which had a much more sort of socialist-oriented politics. And, of course, in response to the meddling and intervention of the United States, which once Chavez came to power just increased a great deal. So he was speaking to the majority. I think he made his coup in the name of the people, and that was very popularly backed, and therefore that's why so many people around the world who had experienced similar kinds of, whether it was colonial or post-colonial situations of dictatorships and conservative and meddling by the superpowers, in this case the United States, were very, very welcoming of what happened in Venezuela and supported Chavez initially.
So when you now talk about an initial period and a later period, is there something suggestive in your answer to say that something changed and perhaps the ideals that he came to power on were betrayed?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that Chavez himself betrayed those, but I certainly think that the trajectory of the Bolivarian revolution that he led deteriorated. It's very similar to what happened with many ex-liberation movements in our Southern Africa region. So what we had is we had fairly radical, in many cases armed insurrections or guerrilla wars that brought to power liberation movements in the name of the people, national liberation. And then once in power, you begin to see fairly similar kinds of things happening over periods of time, which is some corruption sets in, patronage, institutional, you know, increasing gap between the bureaucracy and the state and the people, increasing intolerance for dissent and criticism. And I think this began to creep in the latter years of the Chavez regime, because obviously one can't dwell on him. He was running an entire country and a state. And increasingly relying on oil, as everybody knows, is the main contributor to the economy, which of course had its own economic problems that we can talk about. But I think yes, when Chavez passed on, what you had begun to see was many of those elements creeping into the state and creeping into governance. And Maduro has basically, I would argue, taken that to another level.
But if we go back to Chavez, this fascination with his persona and his policies around the world, many people touting the kind of approach that he has taken as an ideal to be replicated in other parts of the world. What exactly did he do on the ground, and what would you say is the main elements of his legacy?
Well, a lot of them are very good, and we must recognize that I think his intentions in terms of trying to redistribute wealth, for example. So let's look at what he did to the main wealth of the country, which is oil. He took those oil revenues, he basically nationalized the oil industry, and said the state will take over. And that created huge problems of its own. So, you know, just much like we have a nationalization debate in South Africa, and some politicians just say, well, nationalize everything. It's not a particularly mature or responsible kind of position to take, because you have to have the capacity to run things. You have to have the capacity to market your product, to export it, to do all, and you have to train people to do that if you're not going to rely, in this case, on the private sector. So he did that, and I think he created a very positive legacy in that sense of a public social sector that was then able to use the funds for healthcare, for education, for land redistribution, for public service projects and social welfare. And the results were very positive in the first, you know, decade or so, which was basically to uplift a large amount of the Venezuelan population out of really extreme poverty and bring them into to have a decent living and decent wages, which they didn't. So in that sense, I think there's a very positive legacy of Chavez. I think where he underestimated, you remember, he was a military man. And I think in many cases, this is where some of the problems began to creep in, because there was a sense of centralized control of everything. And what we saw in other socialist countries or countries that had declared themselves as socialists was that they, over time, began that centralization of power and that use of bureaucratic power began to militate against the very things that they were claiming they were doing for the people, which was to basically that the people should own the process, that they should run the cooperatives, that they should be running the industries. And instead, what you have is you have a bureaucratic leaping that. So I think that was not his intention, but it was a byproduct. But certainly the social and economic legacy he left cannot be underestimated.
I want to take a listen now to the United States Vice President Mike Pence talking just a few days ago, and obviously sending out his own message to the Venezuelan people. And we'll comment thereafter, and I'll just want to probe the discussion a bit further then about foreign intervention and your thoughts on that.
Hola. I'm Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States. And on behalf of President Donald Trump and all the American people, let me express the unwavering support of the United States as you, the people of Venezuela, raise your voices in a call for freedom. Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He's never won the presidency in a free and fair election, and he's maintained his grip of power by imprisoning anyone who dares to oppose him. The United States joins with all freedom-loving nations in recognizing the National Assembly as the last vestige of democracy in your country, for it's the only body elected by you, the people. As such, The United States supports the courageous decision by Juan Guaido, the president of your National Assembly, to assert that body's constitutional powers, declare Maduro a usurper, and call for the establishment of a transitional government. As you make your voices heard tomorrow, on behalf of the American people, we say to all the good people of Venezuela, estamos con ustedes. We are with you. We stand with you. And we will stay with you until democracy is restored and you reclaim your birthright of libertad. Muchas gracias y vayan con Dios.
So obviously, Dr. Dale, we all would know that that's very rich. We intelligent enough to know that's quite rich coming from the United States of America, with its own very checkered record in terms of its internal democracy and its meddling abroad. But when it comes to Venezuela and perhaps other countries around the world, the finger based on such sentiments would always be that the particular leader in power is beleaguered, he is being targeted because of his policies, and you know all the problems in the country is as a result of foreign meddling, and therefore people need to mobilize around the leader. When it comes to Venezuela, does this ring true? Is there very strong evidence to say during the Chavez years as well as present, the United States has been actively trying to change the status quo?
Well, of course there is, and that cannot be denied. I mean, that the history is very well documented on a number of fronts, not just politically, but economically, culturally, otherwise. I mean, the United States, as we started this conversation, has a history, not just in Venezuela, but across for decades, and in the better part of a century, of intervening, backing of dictators and other places. And it's, as we say, it's very rich of the United States, and particularly Mike Pence. But the problem is this, is that there are legitimate concerns and legitimate that any Democrat and any person who is for the people should have about the way in which Venezuela is being governed and certain some of the things that are happening. But that does not cancel out a fundamental critique of the foreign interventionism and the maneuvering of a country like the United States. Let me give an example of our own neighborhood, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. So what we had is we had a situation where because Robert Mugabe was making all sorts of speeches about imperialist intervention and he was the sanctions and that it was Britain that was attempting to get rid of him, and therefore what you had is you had a rallying around Mugabe on a sort of nationalist basis and saying we must protect him at all costs in Zimbabwe. While he was doing things to his own people and making decisions, there were the very antithesis of what he was claiming that he represented. So one has to be very much more nuanced and sophisticated, and I think mature in one's analysis and approach to these things. It's not simply a question of, well, it's foreign intervention, therefore we support somebody at all costs, irrespective of what they're doing in their country. It's to basically say that we are against foreign intervention, that the United States must get out, they must stop being hypocrites, they must basically allow the people of Venezuela to make their decision. If they want to resist and they want to change their government, well, then that's their right. And then we must also, at the same time, be able to critique what is going on, or to be able to at least have a critical perspective, and not just a blanket support, just simply because it's a foreign external power versus a government. So I think that's where sometimes the criticism gets wrapped up in a little bit of a contradiction, is that we take an either-or attitude, and what we need is a sort of more of a multifaceted one that basically does center itself around people as opposed to institutions and individuals.
Just to build on what you said there, Dr. McKinley, I've seen a lot of chatter on Twitter over the past week, trying to critiquing what the position of the left is regarding Venezuela. I just want to highlight one particular tweet and get your thoughts on this. Somebody by the name of Ibrahim Halawi on Twitter says that Venezuela reaffirms what Syria has already exposed, and that is that the mainstream left across the world is lazy and delusional. Its intellectuals, and that's in inverted commas, are bragging or dragging on Cold War binaries, feeding off inertia and nostalgia, and it's a sad day when the world is more desperate than ever for more Democrats. Do you agree with that sort of characterization that, just because Russia is on one side, America's on the other side, America's accused of intervention, people were always tend to fall with the leadership in Venezuela or other beleaguered countries facing similar situations?
I would say that that critique certainly applies to certain parts of the left, but I always ask, who is the left? So, you know, people said the left in South Africa. I mean, you could, everything from, people would say the EFF is left, then there's a left in ANC, or there's NUMSA, or there's the Socialist Revolutionaries, or whatever it is. But certainly, I think there are individuals who still live in a Cold War mentality, and I think that's wrong. We've moved beyond that point, and people themselves have moved beyond that point. My experience as a researcher, lecturer, activist, and including in visiting many parts of South and Central America, and here, it's a universal case. Talk to the people. Ask them what they're experiencing. Ordinary individuals, workers, poor, others that are being exploited, and others that feel. And then take your cue from them. So I think what oftentimes intellectuals, whether from the left or right or moderate, they do is they listen to the leadership, they listen to the speeches, they listen to sort of news reports, and they take their analysis from that instead of actually listening to people themselves. And I think when we do that in our own country, then we get a much deeper appreciation and analysis of the many contradictions, and we can, our critique and our analysis can reflect what people themselves think, as opposed, again, to a predetermined ideological position in which we miss and actually and ultimately, I think, undermine the very democratic and people's will that we talk about because we have just simply not really done our homework.
Regarding U.S. intervention, how would you explain the reasons, or what are the reasons for the United States of America showing an interest in and you know, pursuing such policies? Is it, simply not wanting a country that espouses some kind of socialist ideals to succeed, so to make an example of them? Does it have to do with the oil, or is it something even more complicated than that?
I think it's a combination. I mean, there's a history, of course, on the ideological front of America attempting to suppress or to marginalize or to get rid of any ideological alternative to a system of capitalism as well as profit-making that is beneficial to the United States and the people who basically run the economy of the United States, international corporations. So we saw that with Cuba, with Nicaragua, El Salvador, Chile. You can go on and on, and including on our own continent. So that is a very real history, and it's still a very real concern today. And that forms part of U.S. policy. But then there's the economic side of it as well, which is in the case of Venezuela, an oil question, as you mentioned. The fact is that just the other day, several U.S. oil companies pleaded with the Trump administration not to push sanctions on Venezuelan oil sector. And the reason why is because the Venezuelan crude, heavy crude, is refined in the United States and mostly in the U.S. and in the southern part of the United States in places like Texas and Louisiana, and creates hundreds of thousands of jobs and massively improves the economy of those states as well as the United States. So there is a direct economic issue here, which then gets clouded by the ideological side. So many people are interested in securing oil, and they don't care who's in power as long as they secure the supply of that oil. And then there's others that say, well, it doesn't, oil is secondary. It's the political, ideological, issues that count the most. I think you get both of those things in U.S. policy that then coalesce into a very toxic mix of sort of economic and political imperialism that is different from what it was 50 or 60 years ago, but no less impactful. In other words, it can still, the United States, as we've seen in the Middle East, as we've seen in Africa, as we've seen in Latin America, basically goes into a place and says, you will do as we say, or we'll basically, either mess your country up economically, we'll invade you, or we'll marginalize you. And that is a very, very real thing for Venezuela and its people.
Lessons for South Africa from what has transpired, what is still transpiring out in Venezuela. You mentioned the discourse around nationalization. This was a project that was carried out in Venezuela. It's something that's being touted ever more strongly, part of manifestos as we go into a new electoral period here in South Africa. What do we learn?
Well, we learned that nationalization is not the panacea. Just as private sector, thinking that, the private sector is going to rescue us and create jobs, and all we have to do is give the corporations tax breaks and we just have to let the market do its thing. That's a myth as well. Well, the issue of nationalization that will solve all the problems is a myth. And the reason why it's a myth is because fundamentally most of those who are talking about nationalization are fundamentally talking about state control. They're not talking about socialization, which is people's control. So it's a very different kind of thing. And I think this is where you get why the EFF is finding it tripping over its own ideological rhetoric, because it says it wants to nationalize everything, and then the ANC says, well, we'll nationalize the land, for example, a particular, but they don't have a plan as to how that land is going to be run, utilized, controlled, and what is going to be done with the proceeds and the products. So this is, nationalization is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a question of in combination with a series of policies that are going to ensure that the people who are working that land, whatever it is, then that industry, they're the ones that benefit, not a small bureaucratic elite, whether they're in the private sector or in the state. And that's the lesson that we must learn from the other countries that call themselves socialist, is that just saying that you're socialist and nationalizing everything is not necessarily the best thing. What it is basically then creating a new elite. Instead of in the private sector, it creates it in the state. And a real socialist, someone who's mature and understanding, orients towards the people. The state then becomes a vehicle for those people to achieve those ends. And that's why our discourse, and I think the Venezuelan example, are very important, that we need to go beyond rhetoric, we need to go beyond posturing, and we need to come up with real policies that work and have a proper debate around that.
Final one for you then is the Venezuelan people itself. How do you think they would be able to find a way out between, you know, the calls for foreign intervention and real examples of foreign intervention, as well as a leadership which seems to have betrayed the will of the people?
It's a very, very good question and a very difficult one to answer, because, you know, it's a very polarized society as it is. I think that if Maduro and his government would allow the very, you know, one of the things that Chavez and the legacy of Chavez was collectives at the neighborhood level, at the regional level, at the district level, of people who then were to feed their, you know, issues up and to the state, in other words. And that has sort of been crushed in a lot of this. So to allow people themselves to begin to speak, to begin to dialogue from the bottom up, to begin to talk to each other, irrespective of their disagreements, because the only other alternative is civil war. And more foreign intervention and more meddling, deaths and destruction. And we've seen what can happen in the Middle East when this takes over and becomes the dominant politics. So I think it's the Venezuelan people that must demand that their voices be heard, that they be allowed to have the space to have a dialogue and to begin with, it's going to take time, but to begin to talk about what it is that they, how they can, and there's going to have to be compromises made. That's the nature of things. You can't get everything you want. And to understand that the main thing is to avoid the destruction of the country, which is seemingly at this point a very real possibility.
Dr. Dale McKinley, I thank you so much for speaking to us this evening. He's an independent writer, researcher, and lecturer based in Johannesburg, and his latest book is South Africa's Corporatized Liberation. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Dale.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.